Hey guys, what's up? It's Allison. Welcome to another episode of the Allison Interviews podcast. You know what I love about doing this podcast? Not that I don't love my print interview column, but what's been so amazing to me about doing this podcast is that it's allowed me to branch out and bring you guys stories of amazing people that are not mainstream entertainers or celebrities, but people who have interesting, compelling stories to tell and who have massive followings. Don't get me wrong. But I have to tell you, I've had so much fun finding the most interesting YouTubers and filmmakers and people that are really doing things to impact the world and make it a better place. And this one girl, Jessica Kent, I found on YouTube several months ago. She is part of this, I guess, like subgenre of YouTubers called prison YouTubers. And I know it sounds so crazy, prison YouTubers, right? Okay. But Jessica has, first of all, she's got, I think, close to 600,000 subscribers on YouTube. I think she's got like over 1 million followers across all of her social media platforms. I mean, she's really blown up on social media. But what's so incredible about her platform, and you'll hear this in this episode, like you will not be able to tune this out. I mean, I could listen to her story 100 times. It's one of the most compelling stories I've ever heard in my life. She was addicted to meth, addicted to heroin, selling guns, selling drugs. She wound up in prison where she found out that she was pregnant. And then she was treated so inhumanely in prison during her pregnancy and during her labor and giving birth. And of course, her child was taken away from her and placed into foster care. But this girl was so resilient. She got clean. She got out of prison. She got her daughter back. She started her life over. She now is a successful social media personality. She's engaged to be married. She's got 2 daughters. She is an advocate for prison reform and for sobriety. She works with various nonprofit organizations. You'll hear all about it in the interview. So this is a wild ride. So buckle up and enjoy this interview with YouTuber Jessica Kent. I wanted to start off actually asking you, because I think it was a couple of days ago, I watched one of your most recent YouTube videos and you were talking about struggling a bit with depression. So the first thing I want to ask you is, how are you doing right now?
I'm doing so well. I feel like I post that kind of video like every 6 months or so. So for me to be struggling like every 6 months to the point where I can't get out of bed, that is enormous progress. It used to be a daily occurrence for me where it was just so hard and I couldn't, you know, kind of snap out of it because I was white knuckling my mental health and my recovery. Mm-hmm. So my recovery to heroin and pills and meth was abstinence-based recovery for a long time. And now I'm able to use medical marijuana and it saved my life. So having that extra tool has allowed me to kind of just take a deep breath and pull myself out of this a lot faster than I used to. So I'm doing really well.
So that brings me to, and this is a really common occurrence with people, and I think a component to addiction that people don't understand. So I always had some anxiety, which I think kind of I inherited my chemistry from my mother because she kind of always struggled with anxiety and panic attacks and some agoraphobia and stuff. And her father was a pretty bad alcoholic. Mm. And she told me that she believes that he was actually self-medicating his anxiety. So that brings me to the question, with the heroin addiction, which ultimately landed you in prison, which we're going to talk about. Looking back now in retrospect, do you think you were self-medicating mental health issues?
1,000%. 1,000%. My addiction actually started with alcohol when I was 12, which it sounds, I have a 9-year-old. So to hear like that I was drinking at 12, my brain can't comprehend.
I have a 12-year-old. I'm like, really? Like, okay.
They're babies. Yeah. They're babies. So was I a baby, right? At 12? Yes. So my brain can't handle that. But at 12, I had realized, you know, that alcohol was like, wow, I'm not socially awkward. I'm funny and I'm outgoing. And this like introverted, depressed shell of a kid who has undergone childhood trauma, And, you know, moving around from school to school, and I was super, super depressed and super strange. I realized alcohol helped a lot with that. I didn't understand at 12 just how severe my mental health was, or that alcohol was even addicting. Because we had learned at 12, I think it was 20 years ago, that drugs are bad. Say no to drugs. We didn't talk about alcohol 20 years ago. We didn't talk about mental health 20 years ago in the way that we talk now. So I get a lot of criticism online because people are like, how could you not know alcohol was addicting? Because 20 years ago, it was very different. So I medicated it out with alcohol. I got placed on what is called PINS probation, which is person in need of supervision. And boy, was I. That was
Is that part of the juvenile justice system?
So it was through the school. The school, what they do when you have a troubled kid is they reach out to the probation office and they say, we have a kid that is constantly skipping school, showing up with alcohol, getting returned to their parents at night, drunk at parties. And so the parole office and probation office will work in tandem with the high school. And I was immediately placed in like drug and alcohol counseling and all of that. But to answer your question shortly, yes, I was self-medicating mental health with alcohol at the time.
Well, I'm glad you gave that context, because here's the other thing I want to bring up is before we get to how it progressed to heroin and everything else, is that the first thing that came into my mind as you're telling me all of this is, well, why didn't somebody get you therapy for your mental health issues? Because I grew up in, and I didn't have a, you know, a Leave It to Beaver fairy tale existence by any means, but I did have a stable home with parents who said, oh, let's take her to therapy. But you did not, you know, not everybody has that opportunity. Not everybody has that kind of positive intervention. So you're in a situation where you're moving around a lot, you're transferring from school to school, you're not in a stable home environment. It's not like someone's going to say, hey, Jessica, you know, why don't we see about getting a child therapist? You know, it's because clearly you're having some anxiety and depression issues. It sounds like you were left to your own devices to medicate yourself, if I'm correct.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was left to my own devices until, gosh, 13, I think, is when I got put on PINS probation. But 13 was a very important time, an important year in my life. It was when I moved out of my home with my mother and into my dad and stepmom's home. My mother struggles with severe depression, and I was in Section 8 housing, and we moved around quite a bit, and there was no stability, and my mom didn't really know how to handle her own depression as well as raise a teenager. So she really did kind of leave me to kind of deal with these things on my own, not intentionally or maliciously, but just because she didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. So at 13, my mom kind of just put her hands up and said, I'm losing her. I don't know what to do. I need help. And that's when I moved in with my dad and my stepmom, who are a stable force in my life. And they gave me stability from 13 to 18. But at that point in my life, I felt so misunderstood. I was definitely like Kurt Cobaining it all the time. You know, I really felt just so isolated. And my parents had no fundamental understanding or foundation for addiction. They never experienced it. My dad and my stepmom, they did not understand. And then my dad was severely in denial. You know, not my kid. My kid's fine. She just has teenage angst. She'll figure it out. She's okay. My wife is dramatic and what have you. And
oh, so your stepmom was like ringing the alarm bell saying something ain't right here.
Every single day. And my dad was like, absolutely not. She's totally fine. I totally wasn't, but I realized looking back that that is just a very common coping mechanism when parents don't know how to deal with addiction in teenagers. They're like, it's not really that bad, or they're going to figure it out, or it's just this, or it's just that. And they try to kind of work around that without saying like, holy shit, this kid needs rehab immediately and programs and therapy and medication maybe, and she needs something else.
Who introduced you to heroin?
Well, just to back up a little bit, from alcohol, it went to pills. And these were just people that I would meet on the party scene, just friends of mine that were a little bit older. And I didn't get introduced to heroin until I was 17, I think. Okay. 17. And this was an older guy that I had met at a trap house. And he looked so cool to me. I thought he was very intelligent. He has passed away since from an overdose very recently, actually, but he was very well read And I was very well read because I'm a super nerd. And I looked up to this person in a way because I thought he was so intelligent. He was studying psychology and in a bachelor's degree program. And I thought, wow, this person's so smart. He said to me the day that he introduced me to it, "You're spending all this money on pills." Well, I can't get pills. You're not going to find pills here. They're too hard to get. They're too expensive, but I can give you something better and something cheaper. And that's how I got introduced to heroin, because the pill market was really tough in New York at the time. They were changing oxys to like these gummy gel Skittles like things, and people didn't like them, and they were just really hard to get. You know, they saw a huge push from people in New York that they were getting addicted to them, and there was overdoses happening. So they tried to change that market, and that's when everyone started doing heroin.
Oh my gosh. So you were living in New York at the time?
Yes. Yep. I was born and raised in upstate New York.
Okay. So it was basically like, here's a cheaper, easier, it's an opiate. What would be the equivalent? Was it like OxyContin is kind of the pill equivalent?
Back then, it was OxyContin, oxycodone, hydrocodone, Percocets. That was the equivalent. And I would take anything I could get my hands on that was a downer. So heroin replaced all of that. It's now fentanyl. Now we're seeing fentanyl in literally everything. And it's so scary. But back then, fentanyl was kind of unheard of to have. It was very hard to get, very expensive. But now, man, times have changed.
Okay. So you're using, and then somewhere along the line, you're selling it also. And I'm thinking that's when the legal problems start.
Yeah, I was arrested at 17 for criminal sales of a controlled substance. I had sold some pills that I got my hands on to a kid that overdosed. I didn't understand. He survived. He did live through that. Okay. I didn't understand the severity of that at the time. Not that that's an excuse, but I thought, you snitched. I'm basically being raised in the street at this point. And to me at 17, I just thought he should pay for what he did because I got arrested because of him. You sold him drugs and he overdosed. He could have died. You need to take responsibility for what you did. This is serious. I didn't see any of that.
So you're mad at the guy that gave you the pills to sell.
I'm mad at the guy that I sold to because he overdosed and then snitched.
Oh my God. Oh yeah. Okay. Okay. So correct. It was a very unconscious moment. Okay.
Yeah. I sold to this guy that was the same age as me, kid, and he overdosed. And then in the hospital told them that he got them from me. And I was actually arrested on school property, which is super embarrassing. And yeah, I was charged with criminal sales of a controlled substance. My immediate knee-jerk reaction was to go beat this guy up, not to stop selling drugs. Nope, because I just would not take any responsibility for my own actions.
Okay.
And I think that's kind of common in a lot of teenagers. Escalated it a lot and was really aggressive. And, you know, during the course of my teenage years, I was also a really violent person. And I was getting in fights all the time. I was severely bullied all of my life. So when I was a teenager, I started to beat people up that talked crap to my face or make fun of my teeth or my clothes or whatever. And I thought that was the only way to get them to shut up. And now I get bullied on the internet every single day. It never stops.
Okay. So here's what I found impressive about you. The way that I found you actually was that, and I do not know how this got into like my algorithm on YouTube, but somehow I came across Christina Randall's videos. Now, she's another very popular YouTuber who did time in prison. I think it's possible because you did an interview with her that then I found you. And then I got like really into your story. And one of the things that really hooked me on your story was, so you go to prison. How did you end up in prison in the state of Arkansas, first of all?
So in 2011, I went on the run from some felony charges that I was actually innocent of. Okay. This was conspiracy to commit armed robbery, grand larceny, false written statement, and false police report. I was working at a smoke shop. Long story short, the guy I was dating at the time robbed this store. And I was working at the time. He robbed the store to pay back my drug dealer. And I did everything I was supposed to do. You know, to me, this masked person came in, put a gun in my face. I gave him the money. And then I immediately, within 30 seconds of him running out of the store, I called the cops, you know, because I wasn't thinking that this was my boyfriend. I was like, oh, we just got freaking robbed. Mm-hmm. And I was very calm during this whole scene, like looking back on it, because I was on heroin. You know, so I'm like, oh, he came in, he was wearing this. I called you guys, now you're here. What's up? You should not be that far. What's crazy is my boyfriend was on scene within 2 minutes consoling me. And he whispered in my ear, it was me. You're okay. So now I'm like, meh, now I have to stand here and act like this is like what? So that was hard. They obviously wanted to charge me with this as well. Once they found out he did it, he confessed to the crime, was put in prison. I went on the run. Because I'm not going to fight this case from the county jail detoxing from drugs. No way. I'm going through that again. I'm just going to go on the run. And I had something very clever and very awesome at my disposal to go on the run, which was not something that was new to me at this time. It was called Magazine Crew. So a magazine crew travels around the country. They do door-to-door sales and they sell magazine subscriptions. And they stay in a city for 2 weeks at a time and then they move. Like American Honey. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie. Very similar to that. So here I am traveling the country with this magazine crew whenever I felt like going on the run from a drug dealer or parole or whatever I was running from at the time. This was felony charges. Well, I kick heroin for the last time, cold turkey, in February of 2011. And I felt really strong that I had quit heroin. And I was drinking alcohol and not taking care of my mental health, not taking care of my recovery, just working really hard, drinking every night. To the point of getting blacked out, like blacked out drunk. Well, my magazine crew was eventually in Vegas, and I get a call from an old runner of mine, a runner, somebody that sold drugs for me. He used to sell drugs for me in New York. He's in Arkansas. He calls me one day and he says, you know, he's the man, he's balling, he's selling meth, and it's just crazy, and he's having a great time, and I should come down there. The next day he calls me again. He sounds out of it, just not the same person, and really depressed and really upset. And the person that I talked to just one day prior was very different. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to take some time off magazine crew from Vegas. I'm going to go to Arkansas, take a couple of weeks and try to help my friend because he doesn't sound okay. Like the conversation was so weird. I don't remember what exactly he said, but I remember being so worried about him. I don't know if he said he was going to commit suicide because he couldn't handle hallucinations, or he had said something very serious where I thought, no one knows him like I do. Let me go try to help him. And I get down there just a few months sober and everyone's on meth in this trailer that he's living in that's condemned. And I thought, there's no way I'm ever going to do meth. One guy in this trailer is carpet surfing. So he's like looking for rocks of meth on the carpet. Someone else is taking apart a computer. And my friend is like peeping up the windows because cops are apparently there. And I'm thinking to myself, where am I right now?
Yeah.
This is so weird. Like a week or so, I knew I couldn't get my friend sober and everyone was doing meth. And I just kind of, I caved because if I'm going to be around people using drugs with 5 seconds of sobriety, that's not really sobriety because I was binge drinking alcohol too and not managing anything, I'm probably going to give in. And I did. I chased that first high that I got for 6 to 7 months. During that time, I started selling meth to pay for my meth and pay for just life, food, whatever I needed. Mm-hmm. And I was able to meet cartel members that were bringing this meth in from across the border and through Texas and up into Arkansas. I was making a decent amount of money. And then I was arrested at, I kind of knew there was an investigation going on, but I was arrested October 20th, 2011 at 4:36 in the morning. And
that's always when they do it. They do it like in the wee hours of the morning. Did they kick down the door? Did they knock on the door?
They were going to eventually, because the Drug Task Force in Arkansas had an open investigation on me and several other people. During this time, about 14 to 20 people were arrested and put in jail. I knew it was hot. You know, I got tips from jail saying, Jess, well, they called me New York at the time. New York, get out of here. They're coming. And I didn't take it seriously. But at 4:30 in the morning, I wanted to leave at 9 a.m., to get on a bus to go back to New York. But at 4:30, I decided I was going to go to the gas station and get some snacks. I don't know why. You're not hungry when you're using meth. But I'm like, I just really want some snacks right now. So I got pulled over by just a very new street cop who didn't know me, didn't know the case until he ran our names. And the Drug Task Force had heard this over the radio and showed up on scene within 3 minutes. So at first, it's just one cop car. And I'm like, I just knew we were going to get pulled over. Like, this makes sense. Here we go, going to jail. I'm texting everyone that I can from my flip phone that texted T9 that I could dispose of. jail Fort Smith, jail Fort Smith, jail Fort. So everyone knew that I was in jail. People that I sold to, maybe they could bond me out. I needed to text my mom so she knew and my sister knew. I needed them to know I was in jail and I was not dead somewhere because they're not going to hear from me for a while. And my brain is going 1,000 miles an hour because I'm high. So one cop gets behind us, pulls us over, takes us out of the car. 3 minutes later, there's all of these undercover cop cars, SUVs, and street cops, like cops in street clothes with just a badge. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, they're going to put me under the jail. So,
right. Great. And you had no idea that you were being investigated all this time.
I speculated because other people were getting arrested, but I, in my drug addict mind at the time, I thought, not me, I'm good. They don't know who I am. I'm not even from here. It's okay. Like, you're selling
this
meth.
Is like the scene from Goodfellas when he gets in the car and they're like, freeze, motherfucker, don't go.
Yeah. Cops are loud and messy and crazy. Yeah. And the drug task force or DTF in Fort Smith surrounded me and arrested me. And I'm looking at their faces and I'm like, I saw him at Walmart in a Thai food restaurant. And in the parking lot of a hotel that I sold meth at. Like, I'm piecing this together and I'm like, I am so fucked. So fucked.
What goes through your mind when you're like, I'm pretty sure I'm going to prison for a long time? What is going through your mind?
I think at this point, I was so defeated in my addiction that it was just like, whatever, you know, going back to jail today, like, it is what it is. There's no mental gymnastics that you can do to prepare yourself for hearing that you're facing 20 years in prison, which is what I was facing. I was always a short timer. I always thought like, oh, I'll just get out of this, you know, 6 months or maybe a year. It's not that serious, or it's just a little bit of drugs. I always justified my actions and I never saw the severity of what I was doing. So they arrest me, take me to the jail and charge me with 2 ounces of meth and simultaneous possession of drugs and a firearm. That's what was in the car at the time. And I'm thinking, okay, I maybe shouldn't have been charged with a gun because that was careless and reckless of me. I had had guns in the past, sold guns in the past, but I knew better than to drive around with a gun in the car. Mm-hmm. So it was just very reckless and very careless of me.
Somewhere along the line, you get pregnant and you don't know you're pregnant. Mm-hmm. And then you are sentenced to prison. So tell me about that, because that is the part of your story that really blew me away, was the fact that you were incarcerated. You did not know you were pregnant. I'm assuming you had to detox when you first were incarcerated. And then you kind of found out in a pretty callous way that you're pregnant. So tell me about that.
So it was this arrest. They take me to jail and they want me to sign for my property, and I'm detoxing in this really disgusting drunk tank cell. And I'm just, part of me just doesn't care. You know, I don't care. I'm here, charge me, take me to a cell, get me out of this drunk tank, because I've been through this before. You know, the cops want to talk shit on scene and the COs want to talk shit. And I just don't care. I don't have the energy for it. So take me to my cell was my attitude, which was really crappy. It was mean to the intake CO, who I'm now friends with on Facebook. We've made amends. It's very nasty to her. And I remember in the morning walking to the pod and girls that were in the GED class saw me in the hallway and they're like, yo, oh my God, you know, it's Jess. And I'm like, what's up? I didn't care. Like, here I am. And I go to sleep in this dorm or in this pod in this county jail, Sebastian County Jail. And the next thing that I remember, I woke up a few times and I'm like, what are my charges? Why am I here? Like, I'm really kicking drugs. And I didn't understand how serious it was. So for whatever reason, someone had filled out a medical form for me to go to the nurse, because I don't remember filling out this form. I didn't even remember why I was there when I would wake up and try to eat a little bit and then go back to sleep. And that went on for like 2 weeks or so. So I would wake up, eat, you know, and just, I was so tired and so drained because I have been awake on meth for months. So my body needs all the rest and food that it can get. I'm sitting in this county jail nurse's station and she says to me, oh, that's why you're so sick. You're pregnant. You can go back to the dorm now. I'm like, excuse me? You can't just speed past there. Like, you didn't just say what you just said.
Like, it was a drive-by, like, you're pregnant and go back to your cell.
Like, no, ma'am, I'm going to prison, so I can't be pregnant. Sorry, not me. You got the wrong one. Definitely not me. Definitely was me. And I just couldn't wrap my head around that.
But here's what I don't understand. Okay. So you're locked up and number one, you're having to come off of drugs, which can be dangerous if you're not monitored properly. Then you're told that you're pregnant and are you even offered prenatal vitamins, an ultrasound, like anything?
None of that. Just to back up a little bit, intake in a lot of jails, pregnancy test every single woman before they're put in a dorm. They didn't pregnancy test me from intake. I found out a couple of weeks into my jail stay that I was, you know, probably a few weeks along in my pregnancy when I was arrested. 3, maybe 4 weeks pregnant. So obviously I have no idea because it's just way too early in the pregnancy to know, but I wasn't given prenatal vitamins for 3 months or so into my stay.
See, that is inhumane.
Yeah.
And these are the issues. And this is why I've been following you and watching your videos because, and you've said this many times, like, yes, I broke the law. Yes, I deserved to be locked up. But there's something broken here when people that are incarcerated are not treated with just like the basic humane treatment.
And there's also a lot of people every single day I hear it. I'm actually working it into a motivational speaking event. If you can't do the time, don't do the crime. But it's not a people problem. It's a law problem to incarcerate drug addicts at the rate that we're incarcerating them. And we're just flooding the system with people that genuinely need treatment. I needed help. I needed help. I understand that what I did was wrong. I know that I broke the law. I definitely deserve to be there. But all of the trauma that occurred after I was arrested was not okay. No prenatal vitamins for my daughter. No drugs to help me detox safely so that my unborn child is okay. I didn't have access to clean water for several weeks at one point in this jail. It was just a really dangerous environment. And I was conscious of that and very scared, but it took me a couple of months to wrap my head around the fact that I have to protect this human growing inside of me because my brain is not there. I'm coming off drugs. I'm facing 20 years in prison. Now I have to figure out how to go to prison pregnant. I don't know how to do that. I don't know what happens. I'm 1,300 miles away from my friends and family in New York. I'm completely alone. The only people that know me are people I sold drugs to or people that my now baby daddy, that's a weird word I never thought I'd personally say ever. I never thought I'd have kids. Now my baby daddy, I'm doing time with women that he cheated on me with that I have to live with every day.
No shit. How many?
I cannot handle this.
How many women that were in there with you that he cheated on you with?
During the time of my county jail stay and then eventually this medium security prison, I would say 5 or 6.
And I'm assuming word got around that you were pregnant with his baby.
Oh yeah. It was the hot gossip in the jail. I was very popular.
Oh my God.
Yep. It was just a nightmare, you know? And I remember telling Micah's biological father, sperm donor, that I was pregnant. And I told him in the hallway of this jail, because he's also at this jail, I said, I'm pregnant. And he said, is it mine? Immediately, my reaction as someone that has not cheated in this relationship was, hell no, it's mine. I got this. I don't need you to help me with any of this. It's mine. I got it. Thanks. Thanks for your help thus far. I tried to do wizard math too. Like, when's the last time that I slept with someone, not him? Like,
Yeah, but you know, like, that is one thing that I find so highly offensive when a man says something like that, because as women, we know who the father is. I mean yes, there are some like weird circle, you know, there's the Jerry Springer crowd or whatever, but yeah. I mean, we know.
We know. And there, of course, there are circumstances where like you get out of a relationship and get into a new one and maybe you don't know. I knew.
Right.
And I didn't want to accept the fact that I have only been with this person for 6 months because I, at the time, hated him. I hated him for cheating on me. I hated him for the way he acted all the time. I hated him because I was getting him out of debt with his drug issue all the time. Like, I really hated this person and had broken up with him before I went to jail, before I was arrested. I hated this person. And I carried that with me for a long time. I don't hate this person anymore. This person gave me my baby. And, you know, I hope that he's doing well. He's still struggling in his addiction. And I hope that he comes out of it. And I really wish no harm towards him or anything. You know, I'm grateful that I met that person because I have my baby.
Of course. So now you're at the point where you wake up one day and you're uncomfortable, you're in pain, and it becomes clear to you that you are in labor.
Yeah.
And explain for people what this was like to you, because labor for a first time mother, it's scary enough, right? It's painful enough. It's scary enough. It's a scary and overwhelming process. So here you are in prison. You come to the realization that you're in labor. Explain how everything went down from there.
So I was, just to back up just a pinch, I was sentenced to 5 years, 15 suspended, 40 years exposure. Essentially, all that other crap just means that if I commit another felony, I am I'm done. They're putting me under the jail. I am off parole, but I'm currently serving, you know, suspended sentence time and exposure time, which we can talk about that in a second. So I was sent to prison. I was sent to the maximum security prison for classification, and then a medium security prison with other pregnant women. And they're telling me what I'm going to feel the couple of months I was there before I had Micah. They're telling me it's going to feel like period cramps, and it's going to feel like this or like that. I wake up one morning and this does not feel like period cramps. This feels like my entire back has been like broken or something. And I'm like, God, I must've slept wrong. This prison cot, am I right? Girl, I'm in labor. So I'm like, this is just crazy. I'm going to go to chow. I'm going to walk off this pain and I'm going to be fine. No, you're going to have a baby today. But I didn't get it. I go to chow and I start to get even more, like the pain is just crazy. And the pain is increasing, and the speed in which the pain is happening is increasing. Never did I think that was contractions, because it didn't feel like period cramps.
Because you were having back labor.
Having intense back labor. And I thought, like, well, this isn't labor. It doesn't feel like period cramps. Another woman said to me, who had like 3 children, I think, she goes, girl, this is labor. This is just different. This is back labor. Because I'm like, it's not like a period. I'm fine. So luckily she was, you know, wise enough, and she had gone through that, and she told me, you need to tell the guard. Well, we told the guard. I walked myself to the infirmary. Every single step was more painful than the last one. And in prison, it's not free movement. I couldn't just walk down there straight. I had to stop at doors, wait for them to buzz open the gate, to go to another hallway with a gate, and they had to buzz that open. And then I had to buzz the outside door open, and then the inside. Like, there's so many things. Every single movement, every single inmate is severely supervised in prison. So it took a while to get to the infirmary, but I thought, if I just get to the infirmary, they're going to make me feel better, and this is going to be fine. You're okay there. There's nurses in there. We're good. No, I get there and they look at me and they're like, did your water break? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't think so. I'm not sure. Does it feel like you peed your pants? And I'm like, no. And this nurse goes, okay, just sit in this wheelchair and we'll wait for shift change, and then we can take you to the hospital. That's it. That's all they did. No one talked to me about what was happening. No one told me, like, you have time because your water hasn't broken. It's okay. When the water breaks, that's like, we need to go, 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 or we're going to call this person, or we're going to monitor your contractions, or none of that happened. I was just left alone in this wheelchair in the hallway of the infirmary watching the clock. It was a little after 5 when I had gone to the infirmary. Well, shift change happens at like 7:30, and they can't do anything until count happens. So the prison has to count all of the inmates, get the count right, which they never do the first time for whatever reason. Like, an inmate goes to the infirmary and they can't figure out why there's a missing inmate at the dorm that I left. Like, it's crazy. So they finally called the ambulance, and I finally got to the hospital around 10 a.m. or so, 9:30 or 10 a.m. And the CO that went with me, it was a male CO from the male side, female CO that I had known a little bit, and they were so nice to me. They were so nice to me, and I got an epidural, and I went into labor, and I had Micah. And I thought to myself, because I've had 9 months to prepare, my daughter's going into foster care, she's going to be taken from you, and you're going to be put back in prison. I thought to myself, just don't look at her, and you'll be okay. Because I'm just trying to protect myself. I know this is going to hurt. Mm-hmm. I spent 9 months protecting this baby inside of me, giving her everything I could possibly think of that was healthy, that I could find, which was very hard, protecting her from people that wanted to fight me. I've been in a very stressful environment for 9 months, but I'm losing this, the only thing that I care about. I'm losing her. Now, all of the emotions I had when I was arrested, from like not caring that I was there and I just didn't give a shit, that changed as my pregnancy progressed.
Because then you're a mother and you completely, and women who are mothers know this, like throughout the 9 months, you go through this metamorphosis. And then especially after you give birth, it's almost like you're thrust into a new dimension of existence. You're completely transformed. And then you've got all of these maternal hormones going through your body, right?
I couldn't have said that better.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so spot on. But I didn't know that like the mama bear instincts were real. Like it's a cutesy way of saying, I will kill you if you try to come near my freshly produced human. Like, I will kill you. I thought like mama bear instincts, like that's a really adorable way of saying I will murder somebody. So Micah was delivered. She was taken to, they wash her off and do all the stuff or whatever. And I'm looking kind of out the window and over here while my daughter's on the other side of the room. And I don't want to look at her. That CO recognized that somehow. And she said, girl, you better look at that baby. And yeah. I did. And I fell in love with her.
And they let you hold her?
They let me hold her. And I held her in my arms. And I thought, I made this. Like, how crazy. I just made this little human being. And she's so small. She was almost 7 pounds, had tons of hair. And I thought, geez, you could cornrow this hair already. Like, is this normal? She's supposed to have this much hair. She looked like a little baby monkey. She had hair all down her back.
Are you serious?
Yeah. It has fallen off, but she had hair. So she's a Laotian. So she had hair on her back, and then she had this Mongolian blue spot above her bum. And that faded when she was about 7. But she had this like blue spot on her bum. And I thought, oh, like my little baby monkey. Like this is the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life. This is the cutest little baby I've ever seen. Well, almost right after Micah was born, shift change had to happen again. And I am handcuffed. My arm was handcuffed to the bed for a long time. It was uncuffed, like in active labor, I was cuffed.
Okay, here's another thing I don't quite get. Maybe you know the reason for this. So a woman is in active labor. You're in an immense amount of pain. Then you get an epidural, which means you're basically numb, because I didn't have an epidural, but you're numb from the waist down,
yep,
right?
So can't move my legs.
You're not exactly like in prime shape to escape, right? You're not plotting your escape.
I mean, mentally I was.
Well, mentally, but I mean, what is the point of dehumanizing and demoralizing a woman who's in labor by handcuffing her to the bed when clearly she's not going anywhere? And you can even have guards stationed wherever you want to have. What is that exactly?
This is just bad policy. The policy clearly states if an inmate is transported outside of the prison, they have to be kept in some form of chains or shackles the entire time. Now, the first guards that I was with, eventually they're like, I'm not comfortable with keeping her arm shackled to this bed. I'm not comfortable with this. So at some point, the CO, the female CO took it off. And the male CO was like, I'm going to step outside while we have a baby. So I appreciated that. And I was very grateful that he left because I was already so uncomfortable, you know, and the staff at the hospital was also very uncomfortable. But policy states inmates must be restrained at all times outside of a prison facility. So at some point, not sure when, she took off the handcuffs, and I'm holding my daughter and I'm thinking like, I love her so much. I can't believe this. Like, she's so beautiful. And shift change happened. A new set of guards came in and it was another female. And she said, why is this inmate not shackled? And she immediately grabbed leg chains and grabbed one of my legs and immediately shackled me to the bed. So now I'll never forget this imagery of holding my newborn baby. She's 2 hours old, maybe. And I see the chains around my leg. So I'm chained holding a newborn baby. And I thought, how did I get here? How is this okay? From drug charges? This is insane. And I was so ashamed and so humiliated and so embarrassed. And I was left chained in that bed for 2 days. That guard and then several other guards, they didn't want to unchain me to go to the bathroom because it was so inconvenient for them to unchain me so I could pee. So I only went to the bathroom, I want to say 2 or 3 times in a 2-day time period, maybe more. Trauma changes and skews your memory, but it wasn't that much. The doctor also came in and said, she needs to get up and walk around so that she can heal her body properly. You know, she just had a baby. The guard looked this doctor dead in her face and said, no, it's against policy.
And by the way, I think that medical policy should trump criminal justice policy, so that the physician should have the precedent to say, when it comes to health and safety of the patient, I get the final say, not you. But that's another thing that obviously is broken within the criminal justice system, clearly.
These guards, some of them have, they feel like they have unlimited power over you, and they feel like what they say goes, and no one can ever tell them otherwise. And they're also really intimidating. So I think that this nursing staff and the doctor, I think they were just genuinely intimidated by these people,
right?
You know, and that made me feel like I was less than, and that no one was on my side, not even a doctor, you know. But something that was really good that happened was this doctor, I was only supposed to be given 24 hours with my baby in this hospital. That doctor said that I had to stay there for an extra 24 hours. I have no idea why. I'll never know, because I don't even remember the doctor's name, but I was so grateful for that. So I got to stay with Micah for 2 days, and I was walking around some the day that I had to go back to prison, but it was very hard to walk because they had kept me in that bed for 2 days. So I was limping and very, very sore, very sore. The hospital gave me some stuff to discharge with. And I was told, your daughter's going into foster care because you were going back to prison. And that's just what it is. We're going to take you back to prison, and they're going to come in and get the baby. Well, I am standing in front of this bassinet. Micah is in the bassinet, and the guards are at the door behind me, and they say, Kent, it's time to go. I told them no. And you don't do that. You can't tell an officer no. So they came in after trying to reason with me, and I completely ignored what they said. Like, don't do this. We don't want to hurt you. We're not trying to hurt the baby, or whatever the fuck they said to me. I have no idea. I'm not leaving this baby. You're going to have to physically remove me from this hospital room. I can't leave her here, you know, because that's just my instinct of, I just gave birth to this human. My hormones are all over the place. Must protect human. That's all I'm thinking about. They grabbed me from behind very hard, and they grabbed me and pulled me and threw me into this wheelchair, where they quickly shackled me up everywhere and flew me in this wheelchair down this hallway to get me to the prison transport van. Now I am chained up. My daughter is alone. My newborn daughter is left alone in this hospital room. I don't know where she's going, who she's going to. They didn't tell me anything at all. And now I'm just getting flown through this hospital. People are staring at me, super awkward, super uncomfortable, so embarrassing. And I am quite literally thrown into the prison transport van and sent back to the prison. And at this point, my memory is like completely gone. I remember little tidbits of the officers when I got brought back to the prison. They're kind of just whooshing around me. I know they asked me questions, but I don't know what they said. For whatever reason, I woke up the next day in the infirmary, which is the hospital wing. I don't know why I'm there. No one tells me why I'm there. And my memory is completely gone from what happened afterwards. I do know they didn't let me have the things that hospital issued for discharge. So I'm having to use prison pads after a delivery, which is not ideal situation at all. And I stayed in that infirmary for over 2 weeks because I couldn't talk to them. I mean, I had the ability to speak, but nothing was coming out. I couldn't talk. And it was so traumatic for me leaving her there that I was just like a shell of a person for 2 weeks.
So here's what's amazing to me is that in more than one way, you beat the odds. You beat the statistics, because more times than not, you'd hear a story. The baby got lost in the system. The mother was never reunited with the baby. It is what it is. But you somehow found the resolve to say, I will reunite with my daughter. I will gain back custody. And you had nothing. You were an inmate. You had no resources, zero. And somehow you managed to make that happen. You reunited with your daughter, got her out of foster care, got custody back. I mean, how did you manage to beat the odds in that way?
One day at a time. So that decision was made in that infirmary 2 weeks after my daughter was born. I woke up one morning and I thought, you need to get out of this bed. What are you doing here? You can't take classes here. You can't make your jacket look good here. You have to go do parenting classes, thinking errors, anger management, drug classes. You have to get out of this bed. And I was just kind of set on fire for that. You have to prove them wrong. You have to get your daughter, get this baby back. You can do this, but you can't do it from this bed. And that's what I did. I started this case, my DHS case of getting my daughter back. I started from prison. Now, I didn't know where she was for 4 months. I didn't know what she looked like or if she was safe, because the foster mom, she was trying to send me like 50 pictures at once. And the prison said, no, you can't do that. They were just sending back the pictures. And she's like, what the hell? I'm trying to send Jessica pictures of Micah. You know, she's growing so fast. Well, one day out of nowhere, I actually have a prison journal of like, I just don't know where she is. No one's telling me anything. Mm-hmm. One day I got a picture of Micah in the mail and she was huge. I was not a newborn anymore. And she was so beautiful. And that helped me, you know, continue on this fight to take all these classes and learn about early childhood development and learn about psychology and learn about my own addiction by myself in my, on my jail bed. And I was really just kind of very focused. At 6 months, Micah was 6 months old. We had a court case. The judge told me, obviously you're still an inmate, so there's not much that we can do at this point, but on your release date, we're going to schedule another hearing. At that point, I want you to come in and let us know of what progress you're making towards getting custody of her. And I thought, oh, okay, well, I can do that. What choice do I have? So I went back to prison and I kind of just focused on learning everything I could about my addiction so I didn't relapse. When I got out, I was paroled to a halfway house with prison shower shoes and sweatpants that said 711-548. It's all I owned in the world.
And that was your inmate number.
Right. So I got a job at a telemarketing place where I literally walked in borrowed clothes. And I said, look, I just got out of prison. I'll work as many hours as you'll give me. I'll be the most hardworking person here. Please give me a chance. I need this job. He hired me on the spot with no ID. Wow. And said, I'll give you a chance. Make sure that when you get that ID, you give it to me so I can put it in your file. You start tomorrow. And I thought, like, I just got a job. Well, then a couple months later, I got another job at a vapor store or a smoke shop, and I was able to negotiate my salary of $8 an hour to $10 an hour. And, you know, along the way, I saved as much as I could, got out of the halfway house and stayed with a friend that let me stay there for free so that I could save up money. So I definitely got help along the way. That was a huge moment for me in being able to save the money for first and last month's rent for an apartment. But I had so many struggles along the way. No one wanted to rent to a felon in Northwest Arkansas. The judge said the lease has to be in your name. I was able to find a hoopty car for $2,000, which was all of the money I had in the world. So mm-hmm. then I had to save again for the apartment. The judge in my case gave me an extension, a 6 month extension to make sure that I could get an apartment, make sure that I could get the car and have a good stream of revenue. My coworkers donated furniture to my daughter and clothes to her. And I set up a room for her when I finally got an apartment. So I had help along the way. And I was so grateful for every single thing. I mean, they donated stuffed animals and everything because I couldn't afford to buy her even a toy. Eventually, right before my last hearing, before I was able to have Micah for overnight visits, I got a job at Landstar, which is a transportation company. So I was a freight broker for Landstar, which is a consistent salary paying job, good job. So I have good income down. And during the course of my first year out, what I would do, and I'm sorry if this is all over the place,
no,
I would visit
fine.
Her for 2 hours, but she was placed 4 hours away from me.
Is that always the case where in a situation like this, where the foster parents are so generous and so supportive? I don't think that's the norm.
I feel like my story is a unicorn story because foster care is often a funnel for prison and abuse and drug addiction. And foster care can be a very dark place for so many kids. So that's why if I could foster, I would love to. We need good foster parents. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, I can't be a foster mom because I'll love them. Well, then you are who they need.
Right.
You know,
right.
If you have all of that love that you're saying to give, then please open your home to foster babies. And because I'm a convicted felon, I can't. So I'm going to be fostering dogs since I can't foster humans, but it's okay. So yeah, I visited her for 2 hours and then 4 hours and then 6 hours.
Okay.
And I got overnight visits, which sounds great. But the reality of it is I have to drive 4 hours, pick up my daughter, bring her back to my apartment 4 hours away, spend the night and drive her back 4 hours and drive home 4 hours. So my gas bill doubled when it came to overnight visits. And I was so tired and so stressed. And Micah was confused. You know, she had been with the foster family for quite some time. She was a toddler and it was just me, you know, and the foster family, they're so great. And we kept the door open for them. And, but Micah was confused and it was hard. And I second guessed myself every single step of the way at that time, because I thought, you're taking her out of this home when this is all she knows. And they have other kids that she loves. And you're taking her away from this couple that seems perfect. He's a police officer and he's great, which is ironic that he's a cop and not a criminal. And they're just such an amazing team of people, their whole family. I mean, I just adore this family.
Yeah.
I felt like I can't even cook spaghetti and she is Joan Cleaver. That's how it felt. And I really was hard on myself and I doubted myself. Well, finally, they gave me temporary custody. So now Micah gets to stay in my home all the time. And I have daycare vouchers, which really helped because daycare is so expensive. And
how did you get daycare vouchers for anyone who's going to be listening that wants to know?
Unfortunately, the judge in my case gave them to me. It wasn't something I applied for. So I'm not exactly sure, but I think that you can go and apply for them if your income is below a certain amount.
Got it. Okay.
You can't apply.
So the shame that you were feeling, like, should I take my daughter out of this stable, beautiful, loving home? Mm-hmm. What's interesting about that is that to me, the answer was certainly yes, because I can't even tell you how many adults I know who have been adopted, or, and not that there's anything wrong with being adopted. Like, if that is the best option, that is the best option. And that's a beautiful thing. But there is a fundamental need, if you can, to be with your biological mother, you know, and the fact that you were so resolute in improving your life, you weren't still in the sickness of addiction. You were really, you were taking all of these steps forward. I mean, let's face it, there is a fundamental need for people to be with their biological mother, if it's possible, mm-hmm. which in your case it was. So,
you know, I recognize that now. And thank you for saying that. At the time, the problem was right close to my face. So I couldn't see the full picture necessarily. I just knew, and at all times, I thought I was going to lose this fight, honestly. But I wanted Micah to grow up and know I fought for her till the end. So even though I didn't necessarily think at all times that I was going to win this case, I was going to fight as hard as I could. Now, that looked like going to therapy, going to NA and AA meetings, complying with everything that parole said, not doing drugs or failing drug tests, going to every single visit. I would get hair follicle drug testing that was ordered by the court as well. So they're constantly taking my pee, taking my hair, making sure that I'm not on drugs, getting two jobs and then a consistent job and then a car and then an apartment and everything she needed. It was all I did. I was obsessed with winning this case, or at least fighting as hard as I could, so that everyone, including myself, knew I did everything I could. And even if I lose, guess who's going to file an appeal? I'm not going anywhere. Right. I will fight until my last breath. And I'm also grateful to the foster family at this time, because they said, Jess, if she goes up for adoption, we will adopt her and you can move here and you will be part of her life regardless.
Oh my God.
When Heather called me and told me that, because maybe I called her crying because it was so hard, you know.
And like, Heather was the foster mother.
Heather was the foster mom. I have interviewed her on YouTube. Amazing woman. I probably called her crying, like, this is so hard. I don't know what to do. She's like, either way, we see your love and bond with Micah already. And it would be cruel to not allow you a place in her life. So if it goes this way, you always have a home with us, or the door's always open. You can be here. I was so grateful for that. But deep down, I felt in my soul, this is my baby. She belongs with me. Every moment of doubt, every time I felt like I wasn't good enough, every time I felt like, am I really making the right decision? Deep down, I knew this is my baby and I have to fight for her. She is my sole purpose right now. And basically always, my kids are everything to me.
And how old was Micah when you got full custody?
2.5.
Okay. So still very, very young, which is awesome.
And so when I walked into court for the last time, Micah was in this really cute polo and I was dressed up for court and I thought, this is it. Here's the moment. Eat some goldfish. We got this, girl. So we walk in, I was shaking. I was so scared. But I had gone in a courtroom 100 times, you know, for criminal charges, and I didn't care. And here we are. This is different. I was shaking, scared. I was dating my fiance that I'm with now. I was dating Reese at the time. Reese and I did not live together though. We dated for a year before he moved in because I just wanted to make sure if I'm going to introduce my child to a man, that this is the man. I was very cautious with that, but I'm texting everyone, my mom and Reese and the foster family, like, here we go. Here we go. I'll call everyone when we're done. I walked in, heart beating so loud, I swear the judge can hear it. And she's so quiet. She didn't even look at me. You know, she's just reading all these papers, my pay stubs, my hair follicle drug testing, a letter of recommendation from parole, my lease agreement, just everything, car title, all the stuff. I had to show pictures of my house so that she could see like where Micah would be. I mean, it was just crazy. This is so random. It has nothing to do with what I'm about to say. The duplex that I got was so janky. It didn't even have a refrigerator. Okay. I assumed there'd be one.
Right.
Weird. So there were so many obstacles. And the judge is going over all of these things in complete silence for what seems like 8 years that I'm standing here, just aging in front of her. And she looks up and she says to the DHS team, she goes, do you have anything to say or any objections to recommending full custody? Or something like that. And they said, no. So the judge looks at me and she goes, Miss Kent, I don't know if I've ever seen someone work this hard and make this much progress in such a short amount of time. Unless there are, again, no objections from CPS or whatever they call it there, I am going to grant you sole legal custody of Micah. Good luck to you. And I'm like, I can go. That's it. We're done. And she goes, yes, you're done. You can go. And I am like, I lost it, crying. I just can't believe it. I grab Micah and scoop her up and I walk out to the hallway and I just hit my knees and I'm hugging Micah and crying. And I told her, we did it, girl. We did it. We did it. And she doesn't know what that means, but I know what that means. Like, we did it.
Does she know the story now? Does she know the whole story?
So she knows what a 9-year-old can handle. Okay. So we have age appropriate conversations about stuff like this.
Right.
In fact, my kids also write me tickets and send me to jail all the time. They think it's hilarious, but we talk about jail all the time. They know what I do. And I told Micah that she was with mommy during the most difficult time of her life. Mm-hmm. And our story, mine and Micah's together, is why I have 1 million on TikTok. Our story together is why I have all the subscribers on YouTube. And I try to include Micah in that as much as I can, because if it wasn't for this moment and if it wasn't for Micah, I would not want to fight for prison reform. I would have wanted to forget all about my past. I wouldn't be, you know, what I am online if it wasn't for her. So every single milestone, I make sure that Micah knows, like, this is your story too. You know, I can't take full credit for all of this, girl. Like, you did this with me. So they know that I have 2 daughters now, Micah and Riley. Mm-hmm. They both know that Micah was with me in jail. And that's why we like ramen noodles so much. And I have these kind of cute conversations with them about it. So they can understand.
Right.
I don't say addiction. I don't say drugs. I don't say things like that. I say, I used to take things that made me really sick. And I used to sell things that made other people really sick.
Right.
And there are consequences for our actions. And mommy had to go to jail. Just like if your tablets get taken away or if you're in timeout,
right.
It's, you know, consequences for your actions. So they understand it as best as children can. But I would like to add that I think it's really important that we have these conversations with our kids and that they know about mental health and they know about jail and they know about addiction in the ways that children can understand.
You
know,
of course.
As they get older, I think it's really important that I'm continuously open with them. You know, they know about my sadness. I don't call it depression to them. They can recognize the word sadness. So we make cupcakes when mommy's struggling with her sadness, or, you know, the movie Inside Out. Like, can you guys just drag me on the ground? I'm sadness today. You know, so that's how I talk about it with them.
Yeah.
And it's just, I have found so far, I'm not the perfect parent by any means, but I have found so far they're able to understand and they're able to put things in perspective for their own emotions. You know, like, it's really hard to deal with anger. It's hard. And sometimes we lose control of that. It's really hard to deal with sadness. And I think, you know, a huge component to what I do as a parent is helping them manage and understand their emotions instead
Absolutely.
Of necessarily punishing them for emotions.
That is, you know, the best thing that any of us can do, because if you think about the criminal justice system, if you like rewind everything, it 9.5 times out of 10 goes back to childhood, and it goes back to what we are taught about our own sense of self, our self-worth, and what we're taught about human emotions from the time we're really young. And what you're taught about human emotions could make the difference between whether you are a productive human being or whether you wind up going down the wrong path.
Megan never really had temper tantrums. You know, she really was like first kid syndrome for real, like eats vegetables. She eats sushi. She's probably going to be a little chef. She loves to cook. So I didn't really understand like the whole temper tantrum thing until we had Riley. Riley is my little savage baby. You know, she tests me a lot, but I would see parents talking about, oh my God, my kid would never throw a temper tantrum. And I related to that when I had Micah, because Micah handled her emotions very differently. Micah handles her emotions more like me, where she internalizes things, mm-hmm. and Riley doesn't. So Riley is more outwardly and Micah is inward, and Micah kind of like will shut down if she's really sad. So for me, that was so kind of easy to work through when she was a toddler and then a little bit older, because I recognized that in myself.
Yeah.
With Riley, I could never punish her for having a temper tantrum, because that's how I want to act all the time. You know, if I could throw myself on the target ground, you know, because someone's making me mad, I totally would. But people would be like, someone needs to check her into a psych ward.
Right. So we need healthy adult ways to handle our emotions.
Yeah, so I can't imagine punishing kids for acting the way that I definitely want to act as an adult.
Yeah.
I think that's so important for them. And if you have children and you have gone through the same past that I have open dialogue with them. Show them that it's okay to express these emotions. It's okay and completely normal to be sad and angry and have these, you know, very strong emotions, and teach them how to work through it with words. I'm really mad today. I'm really sad today.
You know, and
they're going to see that with example. So that's why I tell them like, we need to make cupcakes. Mommy is super sad today. You know,
I love cupcakes.
The memory is cupcakes. It's my love language for sure.
Yeah. One technique I used to use with my son, because when he was 3, he did used to throw temper tantrums. I don't know how I came up with this, but when he was throwing a tantrum and when he was going nuts and I was like inside going nuts, I would do this thing where I would just look into his eyes and I would just melt from the love that I felt for him. And it would calm me and center me so that I could then have a clear mind and figure out how to negotiate through the tantrum. There's something about making eye contact with your child.
Yeah. Or just
it slows everything down.
Getting on the ground with them and just sitting there with them.
Yes.
It can comfort them in a way that I don't think a lot of people understand.
Absolutely.
You know, imagine if you're so like you're crying and you're so upset and someone just gives you a hug or
yes.
someone just sits with you, you know? So I don't know why people want to think that if my kid's throwing a temper tantrum, we should punish them. Just love them. Like genuinely just love them and get at their level, look into their eyes, maybe hug them depending on, you know, how your child responds to certain things. Just sitting there with them could make all the difference in the world.
Absolutely. So you've now built quite a social media platform. So you have more than 500,000 YouTube followers. You've got more than 1 million TikTok followers. You've got almost 100,000 Instagram followers. So altogether, you're edging towards like 2 million people following your life on social media. How did you build this platform
for yourself? I have no freaking idea. Like I never intended for any of this to happen. I kind of just thought I was working as a reentry helper in a prison. So I was filming little videos for this reentry class, like 3 to 4 minute videos. And then I was fired from my free volunteer, didn't get paid for it job because the teacher moved on. And I was like, wait a minute, bruh, I got a lot more to say. So I thought, film 7 videos about your heroin addiction and put it on YouTube. It's going to be called Heroin, My Road to Recovery. And if people find them, cool. If they don't, whatever. I mean, at least it's there and you got your story out. They found them. And I realized you can't just make 7 videos. Your life is insane. You're going to have to make 700 videos. And the more I started to film, the more I realized how much I love to film. And my audience shared their stories and their struggles with me, or they asked me questions and that kept the channel going. And within the first year, I hit 100,000 subscribers.
Wow.
I still can't I still can't put that into perspective. I still have no idea how many people are following me. I still feel like I film on the floor on my phone like I used to. It just blows my mind. I'm so blessed and so grateful that they, you know, they come to my page every day and they ask me for advice. And my subscribers are the most genuine, kind human beings ever. And then TikTok started like a year ago, and I thought I could film some TikToks and share my story. At first, I thought it was just going to be like fun. You know, like I'm just going to do like the cool boyfriend girlfriend flip thing. That was my first TikTok. And I never thought I was going to share like all the stuff there. And then one day I just thought, you should make all your YouTube videos into TikTok videos. And then I did. And then it blew up. And the one thing about working on social media is you have to be really aware of your mental health. I was not prepared for how many people watch me. I was also not prepared for just how much time and energy that this takes. So just for me personally, it's my full-time job now. And I'm very consistent. I post a lot. I have an editor that helps me with that. But for someone that works on social media, I'm not on it a lot. So I turn my phone off on the weekends, and that helps me with my mental health. But in terms of like how my stuff blew up, I think authenticity plays a huge factor. I'm super raw and genuine, and it's not for everyone. So authenticity and consistency has really done me well, but sharing your deepest, darkest moments is definitely not for everyone, because I'm also letting a lot of people into my trauma. And that has, I've gotten a lot of hate and I deal with it every day. So that's why shutting off social media is really important. Even if you don't work on social media, it is my advice to turn off your phone on the weekends. Mm-hmm. It has helped me so much. As long as your kids are with you and there's no, you know, chance of an emergency or something, turn that phone off. Don't take it with you to dinner. Stop it. You don't need to Instagram your food all the time. Have a dinner-free cell phone.
Right.
Other than the hate and everything, which I'm also grateful for, because it allows people who may have a negative bias on prison, it allows them to hear what an inmate has gone through. And even if they're commenting hate, they're talking about it. They're talking about prison reform. It's not worthless to have haters. Like, they're interacting with it and they're bringing the conversation to light. And it definitely does play a role, but I don't know how we got here. It's just mind blowing to me.
But you have to be so unbelievably proud of yourself, because the handful of people that I've seen on YouTube that I guess they've called themselves prison YouTubers. I mean, it's like a silly moniker, but you know, you've found a way to be this really successful entrepreneur and really like a huge influencer with an amazing platform, and you were able to rebuild a life on your own terms instead of being dependent on people to see past certain things and give you a chance. And that's what I think is so phenomenal.
Yeah, I absolutely have entrepreneurial skills from birth, you know, and that was just harnessed in the wrong way. I was a drug dealer. I was a gun dealer. I was not a real entrepreneur back then. I wasn't a hustler then. I am a hustler now. It's a lot harder. But now I'm a full-time content creator for YouTube, Spotify, TikTok. I write articles for Medium. I work for a treatment center called Groups Recovered Together. I have merch, and I'm a motivational speaker, including TEDx. I can't believe that I'm here, and I'm so humbled and grateful for the chance. And I wake up every single day with an attitude that is gratitude, because part of me thinks I don't deserve all of this recognition, because I see so many other amazing creators that struggle with growing their brand, you know? So I think prison TikTok is great, and prison YouTube is great. And I'm so grateful, but it's a lot for me.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, have you ever made, okay, this is so retarded. I'm sure you did when you were in prison. Did you ever make the prison fudge with the Oreos and the peanut butter?
Thousand times. So okay. Good.
I make it now all the time.
Isn't it so good?
It's so good. But it's terrible because I make it, I put it in the fridge, and then I'm constantly like pulling it out of the fridge and eating out of the bowl.
Yes. The fridge comes in clutch for that. I wish I had our refrigerator in prison.
Yeah, for anybody, like cheesecake. Look up on YouTube prison fudge. You will get addicted to it.
It is so. Have I made it on YouTube?
I don't know if you've made it on YouTube.
I need to write that
down. Make your own version of the prison fudge.
I don't think I've made it on YouTube. So I'm filming that video later. They're asking for another recipe, and I haven't gotten it out for them yet. So I think that is like the perfect one, because there's a million different kinds. You could even make like a cinnamon one.
Really?
You have to steal stuff from the kitchen for that, but you can do it.
So funny. What are the top, let's say, three things that you advocate for in terms of prison reform that you think must change?
First one, a lot of people think prison reform starts in prison. No, it starts with ending the war on drugs. If we can incarcerate half of the amount of people that we're incarcerating, that leaves a lot of resources, revenue, and time to help the other people that are left in prison. So right now, half of our prison population is serving time on nonviolent drug offenses. And a lot of them are miscategorized. I'm technically a violent offender because I had a gun. So a lot of them are categorized as violent when they're really not. So ending the war on drugs would free up a lot of time and resources to help the people that genuinely need rehabilitative services because they are violent offenders that are being paroled into society. First thing, end the war on drugs. In ending the war on drugs, we have to implement treatment centers to help those that are addicted.
Would you suggest that they would be federally or state funded treatment centers?
So right now, most inmates are serving time in state and local jails. Mm-hmm. So we would have to implement the state paying for that. But again, if we just ended the war on drugs, that frees up a ton of revenue that we could be using in those states for that. Okay. Oregon is doing great things right now. They have decriminalized all drugs. So I'm monitoring that closely. And I think other states are as well. And hopefully they follow suit. Another thing is reentry programs that don't look like write a check to pay your bills. Promise, don't do drugs. Okay, now you can go into society. That's what reentry class looks like in prison. Right. It needs to look like job training and job placement programs where society and prison needs to meet and say, like, I have a warehouse. I can employ 10 people. Maybe they can get a tax credit for that or something. And they need to train the inmates and hire the inmates. If inmates have jobs waiting on them, that can curb recidivism by so much. Like, the number is astronomical. A lot of people go back to the streets because they just want to eat and places don't want to hire them. So that's a big component to it as well. And also, if someone cannot be placed in a nonviolent drug program in the street and they do have to go to prison, they need actual resources for mental health and drug treatment. And I think prison fails at treating mental health.
Is there any type of mental health counseling in prison?
Yep. So legally there has to be, but the policy of the prison and what the counselors want to do are two different things. A lot of times the counselor might give an inmate a rubber band for harm reduction because they cut. And then the prison guard would be like, you can't have this rubber band. I'm taking it from you. Okay. We're not communicating. So then that inmate resorts to cutting again because their tool was taken from them. Or it looks like the prison not wanting to give medically assisted treatment to inmates, which can drastically reduce someone's rate to relapse. So there's just bad policies that need to be rewritten, but there is mental health. It's just not very ideal.
Okay. So there needs to be better mental health. And I personally think there needs to be more humane treatment.
Yeah. Solitary confinement is how they punish inmates. That's torture. We know it's torture. All the science is there. The studies are there. We know that what we're doing is wrong. Some states are implementing you can't house an inmate over X amount of days in solitary confinement. Other prisons don't care. So it needs to be a wide sweeping policy change for that specifically.
Okay.
And this takes time because every state is different. At the federal level, they can say certain things and they can implement executive orders so they don't chain pregnant women anymore or they don't house inmates in solitary anymore. But federal inmates make up 1% of the prison population. So the federal government doesn't have wide sweeping power. We need to put pressure on state and local governments to change these policies in the states and local jails. So that's a huge obstacle for prison reform, is that every state operates differently. Okay. With different values, and some states are red, some states are blue. It's really hard to figure out, you know, which direction to go in. And I personally don't give a shit about a political party. I just want to see people being treated better. However we can get those laws passed, let's get them passed, please. And the laws have to be made retroactive because there's a lot of people in prison on weed still. When I live in Chicago, there's weed stores everywhere.
Right.
Still be in prison for weed.
Absolutely. So how can people get involved if they want to get involved in criminal justice reform, prison reform at their state level? What are some things that they can do?
Vote. Voting is really important. I know a lot of people pay attention to federal, you know, who's voting in the president or the next president. Voting at your state and local level is so important. And vote for people that run on platforms of prison reform. You know, pay attention to the bills that they're trying to pass and share that amongst your people or your platform and let them know, like, if the First Step Act needs to go out or this bill is to help end solitary confinement. We can start with so many things. We can make petitions. So things like that is a good start. You know, this is going to take time. America's a big ship. It takes a long time to turn it.
Absolutely.
So being patient is essential, but also voting. And if you want to donate to a jail, say it's period products for women or books, call that jail and see if they accept donations. Sometimes mm-hmm. you might have to be affiliated with a church. So call a church and say, hey, I want to work on donations for this, or call certain places that you have in your area and see if you can work together to donate things to jails.
That's amazing. That's a great idea. Okay. So where people can find you when they go to YouTube or TikTok or Instagram, if they just type in Jessica Kent.
Jessica Kent on YouTube. And if you're okay. looking for me on TikTok, it'll probably come up as Jessica Kent, but it's JessKen12. With one S, just Ken12 on TikTok okay. and Instagram.
Okay, perfect. I want to thank you so much because your story is an incredible story about the human spirit and resilience and recovery. And I just thank you so much for your time. And I can't wait for people to hear this.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. And best of luck with everything, Jessica.
Thank you.
So what did you guys think? I mean, if you're anything like me, you were absolutely blown away by Jessica's story. And I have to tell you, yes, obviously we need prisons. Yes, when people commit crimes, they need to be held accountable for their actions. They need to pay back their debt to society. But listening to her story and listening to how inhumanely inmates are treated, and especially an inmate who is A, trying to recover from drug addiction and detox, B, going through pregnancy, and you know, I have a son, I've been pregnant, I know what it's like. You know, most of us go through our 9 months of pregnancy with our partner by our side and our pregnancy pillow and our prenatal vitamins and da da da. You know, imagine going through 9 months of pregnancy in prison, and the fact that she had to fight to get prenatal vitamins and fight to get even the most basic of prenatal care, and then she had to be in labor and give birth handcuffed and shackled, and then have your daughter ripped out of your arm. I mean, it's just the fact that she has rebounded and risen like a phoenix, and where her life is now, and the impact that she's having on millions of people across the world through her YouTube channel and her Instagram and her TikTok and everything. It's just so incredible. I mean, you guys have to like do the slow clap, okay? I'm just saying. So anyway, in the show notes, I will have all of her social media handles because you have got to follow her. She's doing some incredible work in advocacy for prison reform, for addiction and sobriety. And I love the fact that she says, do sobriety your way, whatever that looks like for you. And she doesn't make a secret of the fact that she does use, I think, some medical marijuana. I think Demi Lovato calls it California sober, and so many people came down on Demi for that. But I have to tell you, you know, it's like we all kind of have to do what we have to do to keep ourselves happy, healthy, whole, and balanced. And I think that she is doing an amazing job. So no judgment here. I love this girl. I hope you do too. Let me know what you think in the review section. I love to hear what you guys think, and I will catch you on the next one. Peace.